Hello everyone, welcome to this episode of Paddock Pass, the podcast where we talk all things motorsport. I'm your host, Evie Spencer, an aspiring motorsport journalist from the UK, and you can follow me on TikTok, Instagram and YouTube at Evie Spencer Motorsport. Make sure to follow my socials and this podcast for lots of motorsport content. Hope you enjoy! Okay, so today I'm here with an incredibly, incredibly special guest, David Coulthard. David, would you like to introduce yourself for the people who have been living under a rock and do not know who you are?
Right, well, there'll be a lot of people, I'm sure, who have no idea who I am, but I used to be a Formula One driver, but that was a full 15 years ago. And since then, I've been talking about Formula One as a broadcaster, first of all with the BBC, and latterly with Channel 4. So that's who I used to be, and that's who I am.
I love it. So let me kind of start at the beginning of your career. So we'll start with like karting. So is that how you got into motorsport?
Yeah, my father had raced karts and had achieved Scottish karting champion when he was 14. So I was very aware growing up of motorsport, you know, Formula One. I would watch with him from the earliest age that I can recall. And he sponsored some local Scottish guys in long circuit karting, which was very popular at that time. And I just seemed to spend most of my weekends at racetracks in the UK, you know, places like Cadwell Park and Donington and Brands Hatch and Silverstone. So yeah, I guess it was inevitable that I would get into karting. My older brother, myself and my younger sister all had little motorbikes to sort of play around. You know, growing up in the southwest of Scotland, there was plenty of outdoor space. And 11 years old, I remember vividly going down to the transport yard, which our family business is called Hayton Coulthard, which started in 1916. But I remember going down to the transport yard, and there was a brand new Premier race cars, as it was called at that time, and a set of Carlisle narrow tires with a Hulandaro engine. And I think I did probably one practice session, and then I was racing, which was, you know, pretty crazy. So I remember getting lapped by the entire field in my first ever race, because I just, you know, there was no preparation back in those days. You just went racing.
Yeah. So how did that kind of help you progress through like the world of motorsport?
Well, karting obviously is the sort of well-established foundation of how you prepare yourself as a race driver, you know, for going into cars, which is the point at which you can hope, dream that you can be a professional. And so having, you know, initially had some success in Scotland and then racing in the what was called the Super One Championship, which was like a sort of UK-wide British championship. So I won that two times and then progressed to one season of senior karting. And then at 17, I was, you know, prepped, ready to go to Formula Ford racing. And my father had this sort of belief and vision that I had the sort of skills to progress and become a professional racer. So, you know, I remember at 14 years old, sitting watching a Grand Prix, listening to Murray Walker and James Hunt. And my dad saying, once you're done with being a Formula One driver, you should consider working in television, because you see James Hunt has made a career afterwards. He also mentioned that moving to Monaco would probably be a good way of maximizing what he imagined would be a 10-year period.
Yeah.
When you could be a Grand Prix. So we're having this conversation. I'm sitting in Monaco and I work in television. So it was almost 40 years on from that conversation. You know, everything that he sort of believed has happened. So it's been quite a journey.
Yeah, and it's all come full circle, hasn't it, really? That's absolutely crazy. So can you tell me more about the road to F1? So you mentioned Formula Ford. So all of that stuff.
Yeah, well, that was the entry level back then. I guess now it would be Formula 4 would be considered the sort of entry level. Formula Ford 16 was a huge formula at that time across Europe. You know, had very strong championships in each of the countries. And the end of season, sort of celebration of that was the Formula Ford Festival at Brands Hatch. Excuse me. So I did what was called the Junior Formula Ford 1600 Championships. One was the Duckhams, I think it was. One was the P&O Ferries, and one was maybe the Duckhams. And anyway, I was so well prepared by the Leslie family, David Senior and David Junior, sadly, both of whom are no longer with us, but they knew well motorsport. My father knew the family, and they were based in Carlisle, which was only an hour from where I am in the southwest of Scotland. And we set about with a program of testing in a 1987 Van Diemen. And then the year I started in cars was 1989. So once we'd done all the testing all over with the 87 car, then we took delivery of the 89 car and went racing. And I won the first few races. And that year, I think I won 22 out of 32 races, both the championships, and finished third at the Formula Ford Festival, which was the, you know, this coming together of all the various championships. So a pretty successful first year in cars, which coincided with Jackie Stewart, former three-time world champion, for those who don't know, founding a team in his son's name called Paul Stewart Racing, which he had this concept of the staircase of talent, which was going to be Opel Lotus, which was the next sort of step up from Formula Ford, Formula 3, Formula 3000, which was like Formula 2 today. Yeah. So he created these three teams within one mother team. Mm. And I got to drive for them for the following year, alongside a Brazilian called Gilles de Ferran, who is a lifelong friend now. His daughter Anna, who is a DJ, is my goddaughter, and she performs at some of the Formula One races. She'll be doing the grid DJing ahead of the Brazilian Grand Prix because her father's Brazilian, her mother's English. So she's bilingual. She lives in Miami, but she was educated in England. You know, so she's a truly international child and you know, very successful in her own right. So a lot of the reason to mention that is, you know, a lot of lifelong friendships were born out of that time at Paul Stewart Racing. Paul and Victoria, his wife, being another example, where Jules, his wife Angela, Paul, Victoria, and myself and my partner very often go on, you know, holidays all together. You know, that's the sort of strength of the relationship that was born out of those early 1990s. So I did Opel Lotus 90, I did Formula 3 91, and I did Formula 3000 92, at which time I'd started being the test driver for Williams, because a chap called Ian Cunningham, who used to work with Frank Williams, had moved to work at Paul Stewart Racing. So he knew Frank very well, and he got me an introduction, and that led to me doing some pretty basic testing, you know, going to an airfield and just going up and down and stuff like that, but eventually trusted to go on a racetrack. And so I was sort of parallel racing in Formula 3000, being the test driver for Williams. And then, of course, the tragedy of 94, when both Roland Ratzenberger and Ayrton Senna were killed on the same race weekend, led to then me being promoted from test driver into being the race driver. And that's how my career started. So it was out of great tragedy that this 15-year journey as a Grand Prix driver became. And as I mentioned at the very beginning in the intro, I did the 15 years as a driver, and I'm now doing 15 years in broadcasting. And that brings us to the point where you and I have met at a kart track, because Dayton, my son, is racing in the UK. And as you say, it's kind of come that full circle.
Yeah. And I think it's always nice to see it all come full circle. It's like, it's nice to reflect and then see the same thing possibly happen with your son. So what was your first time in an F1 car like?
Well, off the back of winning the Formula Ford Championships in 1989, I won the Autosport Young Driver of the Year, which is now a regular part of the Autosport Awards ceremony. But that was the first year that it came about, and it was called McLaren Autosport Young Driver of the Year. And I'd never heard of it before because it didn't exist. And I was at the Autosport Awards in Grosvenor House in London, kilted up, listening to, you know, all the awards being dished out. And they announced me as the first winner, which was a great surprise. And the award involved getting a chance to drive a McLaren Honda Formula One car, which, you know, for a guy 18 or 17 or whatever age I was in my first year of car racing, to then have the opportunity to go to McLaren, be fitted in a car that was, you know, was driven by Ayrton Senna and Gerhard Berger at the time, and then go to Silverstone and do a test, was quite remarkable. And I remember I had moved to Milton Keynes, which is where Paul Stewart Racing was based. And I was living in a house with a family who very kindly put me up and kind of, you know, they had a couple of kids of their own, but they kind of adopted me as the third grown-up child. The Parrius family, Brian and Dom Parrius, were fantastic in giving me a home from home. And I drove up from Milton Keynes to Silverstone, which is about half an hour. Had a test in a Formula One car, which was, you know, quite an experience. But the best thing that came out of that was it made me realize it's just a car. Obviously, it's a very fast car, but the dream became a reality. And I think what it did was, at a very early stage in my career, make me realize it was achievable, rather than this thing that looks way on the horizon that only, you know, superheroes got to do. You know, the reality is race drivers are just like any other people in terms of, they're just human beings, but they get elevated through television and media into being seen as, you know, superhuman. But the reality is they're just blokes who drive fast cars well. And, you know, I became one of them after a period of time.
And I think that's a really important thing to remember as well, because as much as, like, because I'm like super starstruck, but then it's really nice to have know that they're all normal people, and it's just, they're all lovely people as well. So I know what you mean by that. So you mentioned starting off being a test driver for Williams. So what was that like at that team? Like, can you give me any like insider information at that team?
Well, Williams was the sort of traditional great British engineering race team, you know, with Frank Williams as the team principal. You know, he'd overcome a great deal of adversity in his own life, having, you know, almost died in a road car accident, survived, but was, you know, quadriplegic, but had the mental resolve, the mental drive, and the financial resource to have the level of medical support that would enable him to come back to running the team and lead it through his decisions and business to be a world championship team. Patrick Head, who was the the very typically British, polite, booming kind of voice. I would imagine if you know, wartime, he would be a major or a general, and, you know, would lead his troops into battle. You know, a great engineer. And it was a very sort of small team, a few hundred people back in those days. Adrian Newey started really his success as a designer there. You know, he'd been with previous teams like Leighton House and had worked in America prior to that, but that's where he really got to sort of show his aerodynamic leadership. So it was a great British racing team, and the spirit was very much, you know, 10 o'clock, everyone had a cup of tea and knuckled down to the tasks at hand and went racing, and, you know, debriefs after any session were around cups of tea and tea and cake, you know. So it was a very sort of traditional British team in that way. And I remember, you know, I'd make the tea when I went into the factory along with the, you know, the team members that were there. So it was a great education and a great experience, and I'm tremendously grateful to Frank, Patrick, the entire Williams team and Williams family for trusting in young talent. You know, they've given a number of young drivers their start, and without that, it would be very, very difficult. You know, I come from, I'd say, a comfortable background, you know, a very supportive, hardworking family who were able to, you know, fund and support me into car racing. But we wouldn't have been in a position to, you know, self-fund our way to Formula One. So you need the support of people like Williams and, you know, McLaren. Ron Dennis, again, was someone very, you know, he signed Lewis Hamilton up at 12 or whatever age it was and supported his career path to Formula One as well. So, you know, I think we're very lucky in Britain, and we don't probably sing our own praises enough. If we often feel, and with the greatest respect to our American friends, but I think they're much better at singing their own praises. and high-fiving their successes. In Britain, we don't really, it should be a real sense of national pride that most of the Formula One teams are based in the UK. You know, they're truly international teams with multinational men and women that go to designing and building these cars. But I think we should be much more vocal on the world stage as to how brilliant the UK is when it comes to developing, you know, mechanics and engineers and designers. And it's always been a meritocracy, in as much that if you're good enough, you're old enough. If you're good enough, it doesn't matter if you're male or female. You know, there's obviously a big push over the last few years for diversity and inclusion. But I truly believe the sport has always been about present yourself. And if you're good enough, the job is there for you, irrespective of where you come from or you know, your gender. So I think although the sport is seen as a male-dominated environment, that's not because, you know, it's not because of any barriers to others. It's just, you know, that's what has filtered up into Formula One predominantly. But, you know, you are seeing a lot more female faces in many different roles, and not because of tokenism, because they're good enough. And if more presented themselves, there would be more in that environment.
And I totally agree with that. I think the thing is, a lot of women have not been into motorsport in the past. Like, it was very, like, lots of males watched it. It was very stereotypically male fan base. And as women are coming into it, it's kind of being like, oh, there's no women on screen. However, give them time and there will be women on screen. So I completely understand that. I think the move from Bianca Bustamante going to McLaren, that was a really, really cool thing to see. And Jessica Hawkins in an F1 car, that was super cool in the Aston Martin test. So I think there will be women in like driving in F1 soon. And I agree. I think they'll do it on, not because they're women, but because they're good enough. I really agree with that. So you went to McLaren and then to Red Bull. So can you kind of tell me how these teams and their values differed?
Well, I've only ever driven for British teams. So I think that there's a core, as I mentioned about, you know, Williams being that sort of traditional great British engineering team. The McLaren was a bigger team again. You know, Red Bull has grown to, you know, being, I don't know how many, over 1,000 people between race team and engines and all the, you know, the campus they have there now is huge. But the core of these teams is the race team. And that's a small group of individuals who build these incredible cars and take them racing. So the ownership and the management styles may be different, but the core of delivery from the mechanics and engineers is the same. You know, it is, they work whatever hours it takes to get the job done. They see every task as is a problem to solve rather than, you know, a problem that is going to stop them being able to achieve what they need to do. I think a great example of that actually for Red Bull was a few years ago in Budapest. It was a damp track, and as Max was going to the grid, he slid off and crashed the front left corner. I think it was 3 corners from the end of the lap. And instead of any, and the nose was broken, the front wing fell off. And instead of the team saying, okay, come to the garage and we'll try and fix the car, which commits them to having to start from the pit lane if they're able to do so, they said, take the car to the grid. And whilst the car was going to the grid, Max is explaining the damage. They're looking at the television cameras and they bring all the parts that they think they'll be needed. And the mechanics set about rebuilding the car on the grid within the time allowed, and with less than a minute to spare, they finish, the car is dropped onto the ground, the mechanics leave, and Max goes on to finish, I think, second or third in that Grand Prix, which he may or may not have done had they sent him to the garage to fix the car. And it's that absolute belief that whatever the challenge, they will rise to trying to solve it. It's just a mindset and an attitude that most people in everyday life don't have. Most people look at a problem and go, okay, how am I going to fix this? And how long is this, you know, rather than going, let's get on this. The damage is done. Let's not even discuss what's been done. Let's just keep discussing solutions. And it's an attitude thing. And I liken it to everyday life where, you know, people on a Friday afternoon, if you ask them to do something, there'll be quite often people go, yeah, first thing Monday, I'll get onto that. Well, I'm like, it's Friday still. Why Monday? Why not start it now? And you may get it finished on Friday night. And then it's done. So first thing Monday, you're onto a fresh and a new task rather than this attitude of, yeah, I'll do it next week. Just do it now. Just do it now and it's done. And yeah. These are the sort of life lessons Dayton has to put up to listening for me as a father, because he'll say, yeah, I'm going to do that. And I go, well, son, what are you doing right now? Just do it now. And once it's done, you don't have to think about it again. Or I'll tell him to write something down. Because if you write it down, and it was Ron Dennis who used to always say this to me, write it down and then you don't have to remember. If you try and remember everything in your mind, of course we forget things. We're only human beings. But if you write it on a pad or you send it as a message to yourself, most people have their telephone with them most of the time, you know, therefore they have access to email. So I send myself emails as to-do lists, because I systematically always work through my inbox. That's my to-do list. So any mail that comes in is actioned in some way, either personally or through Viola in my office, or filed. You know, that's how I deal with the things that I have to do. And the great thing, when it's written down, you can forget about it and then deal with it when you have the time to deal with it. But, you know, when I'm doing extensive time in the office, which I obviously travel a lot, I'll usually start with the least enjoyable task first. Because it's too easy to do all the easy things, and then the difficult thing or the time-consuming thing, you can keep pushing it under the carpet. Well, I start with that, because once it's done, the rest of the day just gets easier.
Yeah, I agree with that. My life revolves around lists, like, because I am an incredibly forgetful person as well. So I've got a whiteboard next to me, and it's literally just got a list of things that I just need to do. So I think Formula One's quite like that. I think it's very, if it knocks you down, you're all a team, you all work together and you get back up again. So I like that about Formula One. I think that's one of my favorite things about it. So you drove alongside some incredible drivers like Damon Hill, Mark Webber, Mika Häkkinen, all of the incredible greats. What was it like driving alongside them?
Yeah, well, that was as a young boy karting and growing up in Scotland, I think I was fascinated by foreigners. And I always have to sort of quantify when I'm talking about this in foreigners, because of course I'm a foreigner to them if they're Finnish or they're, you know, okay, not quite the same, but if, you know, within the United Kingdom, clearly I'm Scottish. And as we know, there's always a bit of banter between the Scots and the English, and, you know, when we have various sporting events. But I think being a village boy, I saw motor racing as this incredible global sport. And I was fascinated to compete against foreigners and find out how good I was relative to them. And it's been an incredible journey of life to realize it doesn't matter if you're a village boy from the southwest of Scotland, you can compete on the global stage against city people or people that have gone through a more sophisticated lifestyle or education system. You know, I was primary school educated with 75 pupils, and then secondary school educated 3 miles away with 750 pupils. And I didn't go to college or university. You know, I started at Dumfries Technical College to do a business course and computing, as it was, you know, called back then. Computers were still fairly new in the world back in 1989. And then my racing career took off and I left. So my education really is limited to fairly standard schooling. And then where it's been supercharged is this university of life, working with, you know, brilliant men and women who are engineers and designers, where I can be the voice of the car and articulate my feelings and share that with a foreign racing driver like Mika or Kimi or, you know, the Thunder from Down Under, Mark Webber. And we speak the same language in that respect. We speak race car and our hopes and needs and desires. We can discuss with the engineers, and then they find technical engineering solutions to what we would like from the car to give us the confidence to go faster. So yeah, it's been great to work with all those guys. And you know, I don't have a bad relationship with any of my teammates. You know, it was difficult when you are teammates because you're so self-centered and so selfish and so focused and trying to beat them. And clearly, they, you know, in the case of, you know, three of my teammates were all world champions. You know, Kimi, Mika, Damon, Mark Webber led the world championship to the final round, I think it was, in Abu Dhabi. And, you know, was a brilliantly fast race driver. And, you know, I had people like Christian Klein, Tony Luzzi, Robert Dornbos. I'm trying to think if I'm missing somebody. If I am, I apologize. But yeah, I loved that journey. And, you know, Mika and Mark are buddies today. You know, we do a motorbike tour in Portugal each year. I've just got confirmation last night that those guys are doing it again. And along with people like Martin Brundle and Adrian Newey comes along, and from other people outside of motor racing. And it's just great that we have that sort of bond of friendship, because in the end of the day, when you work in the same industry and you compete against each other, and especially as teammates, you get to see people at their highest and you get to see people at the lowest. You very rarely in life do you ever get that. There'll be people who go to work and work in the same company for decades. They'll have very good relationship with their co-workers, but they won't know anything about their life in terms of how do they look when they're full of the adrenaline of success, and how do they look when they're broken, when they've at the lowest moment in their careers. And when you actually see someone go through that, you know, I've seen someone like Mika celebrating a world championship in a car that I had the same car, but he became the champion. And I've seen him in tears through frustration and out of mistakes and failure. So, you know, it gives you a pretty deep knowledge of how that person is, which, you know, I love. You know, I love deep relationships.
Yeah. And I think motorsport really does build the person. And David Sullivan, who is a previous guest on my podcast, he said it best. And he said, it either makes or breaks you. And anyone who's been through the highs and the lows of motorsport is a very strong and strong-minded person, because it's difficult at times. Like, I mean, I've only seen it at karting level. I've not been that close to the higher up levels, but at karting level, even it's just heartbreaking. Like, if you crash out on the first lap, your race is done for, and it's completely heartbreaking. But then also you've got people winning the championship and having a great season. So I think that's really important. So
that was an emotional,
yeah, 100%.
You know, karting is as important as Formula One when you're doing it. That's the thing. You know, you can't be in karting but your mind be somewhere else. You know, you've got to be completely committed, completely immersed. And I always say to Dayton, my son, who's racing and wants to progress into cars, that he's got to imagine there's X amount of people out there who've got the same talent. Some may have more opportunity because their father's around all the time and lives in the UK, which I don't, and I'm not around all the time. And some may have less opportunity. But whatever the difference is in terms of how they get there, doesn't matter. No point talking about it. All that matters is the next corner, the next cart in front of you, the next lap time. That's the only thing that matters. Because if you're going to go, well, I didn't have this, or I'm not with this team, you know, join a long line of people that are making excuses. You know, you just have to play the cards you have and do it to the best of your ability. And although karting is incredibly important, none of that trophy cabinet has any value when you go to cars. It has no value, because if you go to cars and you're getting beat, that's your reality. So what I mean is a sort of contrary thing. You've got to be absolutely immersed in what you're doing in karting, but none of that is giving you a tenth of a second when you go to cars. So I think a lot of parents think because their kids are karting champions, then they should be Formula One drivers. Well, it doesn't work like that, because there's been some amazing karting champions who've gone to cars and they've just been okay. They've been average. And there's been people that have done not a great deal in karting and they've won world championships. There's, you know, two of the last 30 years, I guess it is. You know, you've got Damon Hill and Jacques Villeneuve. Neither of them ever raced a kart in their life, and they both went on to win world championships with Williams. So, you know, that's where, as a sort of, let's say, stand back parent, because I just turn up at a few races from time to time, and, you know, I've got Dave Boyce, who looked after me in karting and has worked with many Scottish guys coming up, and as he's based out of Scotland and others, you know, we run a pretty tight ship in terms of the expenditure for Dayton to go and racing. And that's not me just being Scottish. It's just because I just want them to learn about racing and learn about wheel to wheel and try and be safe. And then we'll get him into cars and find out if he's good enough. You know what I mean? Rather than remortgaging the house to win the championship in karting, to go, look at me, I'm a champion, which you still need to fund getting into cars. You know what I mean? So I feel that I understand why karting has become more expensive and bigger teams and everything, because that's business. And, you know, in a free world, business will always, you know, develop and reward those that are successful. But in a simplistic utopian world, I would like to imagine that karting was a cost cap of making it more accessible for more at the highest level in terms of the teams, which I know the teams wouldn't like because they're business men and women, and I get that. I respect that. I'm not trying to stop someone's business. But it's a very expensive hobby now, because, you know, that's what karting is for the majority as a hobby. And to have a profession as a driver, you need to move to cars. I don't know if you're picking up on my point there. I'm probably not making it in the most eloquent way. Karting is something you need to do, you need to get through and get out of, rather than think that that's your whole, you know, that success now means that I'm going to have success as I go up through.
Yeah, no, I think as well, you've hit the nail right on the head. I think it's not, if you win in karting, it doesn't automatically make you a Formula One driver. You are not a Formula One driver. There's no way. But I definitely understand. I don't think you need to win loads in karting to be good in cars, because it's very different as well. It's similar, but it's different at the same time.
You know, when I watch karting now, there's so much contact and there's so many crashes. And, you know, I pray for everyone's safety, because, you know, there's a lot of young people doing it. And it's fast and it's technical, but none of that pushing and shoving and bashing you can use in cars. If you go to touring cars, maybe, but very quickly you're going to get in problems because of the cost of doing it. But it's, you know, it troubles me to see the lines of people waiting to go this see the stewards at karting, because there's been incidents reported, and it's developed into a very physical sport. Which, if you're a boxer, you're going to expect to get punched. I get that. But in car racing, you know, look at Perez at the weekend. A little bit of contact, race over. You know, there's no coming back from that. Formula One cars today, so sensitive, any contact. So you're doing everything you can to avoid contact in cars. In karting, you see the little sneaky nudge, push someone wide, the block pass, you know, banging wheels and you know, that's part of it, I understand, but I don't like to see it, because it's not a skill that you can carry, that aggressive psyche of pushing past.
And I think a lot of the people who are leading the pack get there because they've done good overtakes and they catch someone's mistake in front of them and they see that opening and they take it. And yeah, so I definitely understand that. And I think as well, Formula One, at what you said, Perez at the weekend, it literally ended his whole race, his home race, because he went for a move and it caused a bit of contact. So I agree with you there completely. So really, really weird side note, but who was the person that you wanted to beat most on track? Like, if you saw your name above them in the results, you are like, yeah, I've done a good race.
Well, look, it's always your teammate, because it was an alien thing to me when I went to posture. You know, Gilles de Ferrin was my first teammate. I'd never had a teammate. I was always just our own karting team. So it was always about me. And then suddenly, when you have someone else as a teammate, it's like, oh, hold on a minute. He's quicker with the same machinery. So, yeah, your teammate is always your gauge, because you can only drive the car you've got. And clearly there's great drivers in Formula One that have average cars, and they'll never win a Grand Prix in an average car. So the exceptional drivers tend to find their way to the top, don't they? You know, your Lewis's and Max and the various other champions of the past. But you don't always get a winning car. So therefore, you're very focused on extracting the most from your car and your team to justify in your own mind that you're doing a good job, and to also, you know, it's a career. You're being paid to do it, and people aren't going to pay you if you're half a second slower than your teammate. And, you know, this is where I genuinely want whoever is doing whatever formula, I want them to experience success, not because it may lead to a professional career, but just the emotional satisfaction of sharing with your team success. It's a wonderful thing. But the reality is, not every driver's as good or good enough to extract as much as their teammates. And if you're not delivering, you've got to expect that you'll be replaced.
Yeah.
And it's harsh sometimes when you're in a commentary situation, because you can be perceived as criticizing somebody. And of course, that is personal.
So you next in your career, you did the Race of Champions. So can you kind of tell me, how did that come about, and what does that entail? And yeah.
Well, Race of Champions is an event that takes place every year somewhere around the world. It was founded by a Swedish guy called Fredrik Johnson, who I've known for a very long time, and I think it's been going almost 30 years now. He used to be married or partners with Michèle Mouton, who was a rally winning female racing driver, and they have a daughter together, Jessie, and Jessie works with Frederick with Race of Champions, and so it's a great family company, and they have a great team of people that are involved annually with the event. So when you go to it, it really feels like a sort of family motor racing type event. And of course, you jump in the cars and you want to do the best you can, but your career doesn't depend on it. You know, no one's going to springboard from Race of Champions into a Formula One career or an IndyCar or whatever. There's various drivers with various levels of experience. And the last couple have been in Sweden, which I wouldn't say is natural habitat, driving on snow and ice. So, you know, I don't go particularly far in that event. But when we've done the tarmac ones in stadiums, you know, sometimes I've won and sometimes I've been out in the first round. It really, you know, it's a slightly random event in that respect. But it's good fun, and I enjoy the locker room nature of it, because all the drivers share a locker room and get changed in there together and talk and laugh. And, you know, in the evening there's obviously dinners and drinks, and it's just a very nice way to hang out and be with other drivers from other disciplines and share the fact that we're all very lucky to be in motor racing. You know, I'm 52 now, so I'm not really sure I've got many more Race of Champions in me. I'm not even sure if I get invited back, but if it fits with the diary, then I normally go along and have a nice weekend.
Yeah, and I think as well, it's so nice to have loads of different people from lots of different areas of motorsport, because as much as you're all driving cars or similar, but they're all very different in their own respects. So it's nice to have like a whole bunch of people who you'd never expect to see together in the same room and competing together. And I think that's really nice. So, basic question, but what is the motorsport life like?
Well, motorsport life, it's, you know, I've just got back from Mexico. I was out there doing my television work, and I come home and then I travel again. You know, it's just, it's like, you know, I'll be at PFI on Sunday with Dayton racing. So weekends, motorsport life is weekends, isn't it? You're always away on weekends somewhere, you know. And back when I was younger, it involved driving up and down the country, and being based in Scotland obviously adds extra hours of travel time if you're kind of based in that triangle between Wilton Mill, PFI, and I'm not sure what the other track would be in that triangle, but then you're maybe only 1-2 hours from each of the car tracks. It's a lot easier, and it's a less time commitment than if you're based up in Scotland or, you know, down in the southwest coast of England. You just have to commit to days of your life sitting in a car or a van to get to the events. Now I spend days of my life sitting in airplanes, traveling the world. So travel's a big part of it, but to be paid to work in an industry that you did as a hobby and as a passion is incredibly lucky. So, you know, I consider myself, of course, very lucky to have been on this journey. I go back up to Scotland, you know, my brother and his wife, I've got three kids, they're all involved in the family transport business. You know, my parents are still living up there. You know, they're still in the village that I grew up in. And it's great, and I love it. But my life has taken another journey, and it involves living in Monaco, and it involves traveling to Mexico and traveling to Vegas and traveling to Abu Dhabi. And I'm not doing Brazil, obviously, because I'll be at PFI instead of the Formula One race. So, yeah, that's kind of it. It's just the same, but just different venues and much longer travel.
Yeah. And I think as well, completely aside from the travel, the training as well. I saw your Instagram post about the drivers in Qatar. So if you could kind of just like tell me what that was about.
Well, when I was racing in Formula One, I had a trainer who lived here in Monaco. We'd meet at 9 o'clock. We'd go and do our cardio session, which might be a few hours on the bike. It might be a swimming session. It might be, you know, running the stairs, whatever it was. And then at 5 o'clock, we'd meet again and then we'd do a strength session. So we'd go to the gym, and a lot of the exercise was based around body weight. So let's say at that time I was around 70 kilos. Then, you know, you'd be benching 70 kilos and you'd be squatting it and you'd be doing all the things to be strong, have endurance, and to be lean, because you weren't looking to build weight. So I was, I think, constantly sore and constantly tired when I was in Formula One. So when I retired, I didn't do any exercise for a year, and I felt fantastic because I wasn't pushing my body anymore. I wasn't straining the body to be fit. And, you know, I've settled into midlife a little bit heavier and definitely not as fit as I was, but that's kind of the journey of life, isn't it? You know, many sports people are not keeping the same training regime as when they're competing. It just, you just don't have the time in your life, and you don't have the motivation, and you don't have the need. So even, you know, Ronaldo at some point, as we see with, you know, Sylvester Stallone or Arnold Schwarzenegger, the muscles will fade over time. You know, the six pack will fade. It's just the journey of life. So there's a huge physical commitment, but that's the job. That is the job of the driver, is not only to drive, but to spend hours of the day training to be able to handle Qatar. And so the Qatar race, I see it like this. I think having a really hard race occasionally is good for Formula One. It's good for the drivers. I don't subscribe to some of the comments I read was, you know, this I can't remember the wording, but people were insinuating that this was wrong to force the drivers to compete in these conditions and that sort of thing. And I think Lewis commented that, you know, like marathon runners don't come finish the marathon in under 2 hours and go, that was so difficult, it should be 25 miles. 26 miles is ridiculous. You know, they go, there's the world record, I'm going to try and beat it by a few seconds. So I think we have to be careful that we don't make things easier because it's difficult. Well, it is what it is. It's so rewarding, and it's so incredible for us to watch these athletes do what they do and go, I couldn't do that. If we all thought we could do it, then would we be as impressed? You know, I watch quite a bit of boxing because I've only ever been punched in the face once, which may come as a surprise to many people. But you know, I couldn't take I couldn't take being punched in the head repeatedly. But they are physically capable and they're trained for that, and they're the sort of ultimate gladiatorial sport. I know some people find it disgusting, and others like myself find it fascinating, and I admire the bravery and admire the commitment because there's nowhere to hide. But it's a free world and they have their free choice, and you don't shorten the bouts because it's a warm outdoor event. It's 12 rounds or it's 15 rounds, and they've got to go out and do their best.
Yeah, and I think as well, it separates the best from the best. Everyone who made it through that race, even like some of the people like fainting in the medical room after, they made it through that entire race, keeping their focus, doing well in that car, and then waited, like held on till the end of the very last lap, and they still did well. And it's just honestly, it's beyond me. I couldn't, like, never. And I think that's the important thing as well, because it really does separate the best from the best.
Yes, so I could do it. I would have been able to do it when I was a young, fit Formula One driver, because I trained for those moments. And we had races. You know, I raced against Fernando. I've seen both of us after 1 year in Canada, both sitting on the floor in the Parc Fermé, in the garage, just, you know, dehydrated, exhausted, because it was a particularly warm race on that occasion. And we were both fit, but we were both exhausted. Fantastic. That's what we trained for. We both finished. And if we didn't want to do it, we could both retire. Someone else will come and do it.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing. I think it really does, as I say, separate the best from the best. So I 100% agree with that. And I think it's good to watch as well, because it's like, it's very inspiring to see people do that. It's very, very inspiring. So you now do lots of F1 and motorsport media. So can you tell me more about that and how you got into that?
Well, the last year I raced in Formula One, 2008, I'd already spoken with BBC. You know, Martin Brundle was my manager for several years. He was, you know, he retired and was working in television. And as I mentioned, my father had spoken to me when I was 14 about looking to television beyond Formula One. So there was no big surprise that I looked for the opportunity, and the opportunity was there. And, you know, then I started working with Martin and on the television, and it's progressed from there to being involved in a production company called Whisper. So that's how that transition happened. And then it's seen me become involved with Whisper, with Jake Humphrey and Sunil Patel, and then into other motorsports opportunities. I have a business called Velocity Experience with Guy Horner, who was Christian's brother. He already had a successful events and experience business, and Velocity is very much focused on motorsport and, you know, events and clients. So yeah, a lot of my life now is still associated around Formula One, of course, television, broadcasting. And it's, yeah, it's fun. It's interesting. I get to talk about a sport that I love to see. I love to be around.
Yeah. So that leads me on very nicely to my next question. So what interests, businesses and hobbies do you have outside of racing?
I don't really, you know, what's my hobby? My life is my hobby. I enjoy life. I'm not a member of the local squash club, or I'm not fanatical about viewing or going to other sports events. I'll enjoy standing at the side of the track on Sunday watching Dayton. Yeah, I feel, could I have been asked this before, and sometimes I always feel it might be a bit of a disappointment that I don't really have something else that I wake up for other than life itself. I enjoy my life. I enjoy what I do. Every day is an opportunity. And sometimes I'm busier than maybe I would like to be, in on the road more than would be normal, and therefore I don't spend as much time at home, or I don't spend as much time with Dayton in a normal fathering way. But that's the life I lead, and he doesn't have another dad, and he doesn't know another way, so you just crack on, don't you?
Yeah, and I think the thing is as well, motorsport's very full on. Like, if you immerse yourself into it enough, I bet it's just completely and utterly just takes over your life. And I think that's good if you enjoy it. So as long as you enjoy it, I mean, there's nothing wrong with it. So yeah. What has been your biggest achievement or achievements, because there's been lots, or highlight of your career?
I guess winning. I really, again, I have to kind of make up an answer for you because I don't have one that instantly comes to my mind. I think I'm very sort of matter of now, matter of fact, rather than reminiscing. You know, up in Scotland, we've got a lot of, well, my first kart, my last kart, Formula Ford, Opelousas, Formula 3, Formula 3000, Williams 95, McLaren 96, a few Red Bulls, the DTM car that I raced, and they're great to look at, but I don't know how I'm supposed to feel about you know, I've not lived this life before, therefore I'm not living in memories of the past. I'm living now. I'm dealing with my life now and trying to make decisions that are best suited for the challenges of now.
Yeah,
very aware of reality, very aware of the clock is moving, and just want to continue to enjoy and experience as much as I can. You know, I don't really have a reminiscent best memory per se, and I don't have a master plan for the future. It's about just kind of being here. But it would, I guess, when I look at old videos, you know, on social, then, you know, winning the British Grand Prix, I look pretty happy. Winning Monaco, I look pretty happy. And of course I wasn't, but you can't live in the emotion of the past. And that's why I'm being a bit picky, I know, but when somebody would refer to their wedding, for instance, being the best day of my life, I'd be like, wow, that is the best day. What about tomorrow? What about 10 years from, you know, to imagine you've had the best as a memory from the past. I'd like to imagine the best, you know, I'm not going to win races anymore and stuff like that, but that's not what defines the best day. You know, it's about having the richest experience, whatever that is, the most amount of fun, the most amount of laughter, the most amount of sense of achievement, however people value themselves. I'd like to imagine that those moments are still ahead.
Yeah, I think that's really inspiring as well. I think just kind of look forward to the future and like enjoy your past, but also look forward to the future. I think, yeah, I totally agree with that.
We're having this conversation in my apartment and I'm looking at a trophy from, I think it was it 2000, I had the plane crash, and the following weekend I raced in Barcelona and finished second to Mika, and I have the trophy in my apartment, and it's not a winning trophy, but it represents a memory from the past and a week where tragically the pilots were killed, but luckily for me I survived, and that represents a moment in history. So I don't have any other trophies. Well, actually, I've got the Race of Champions trophy that I brought back. Dayton wanted it because it's huge. But other than that, I don't really have a lot of racing things in my apartment. So I don't know why. I saw it out of the corner of my eye and chose to share. So there's a significant moment from my past that doesn't involve winning or you know, celebrating anything other than surviving.
So what are your plans for the near future? So I know you're taking Dayton racing on Sunday, but around that as well.
Well, I'll be travelling to the UK tomorrow for a meeting in London. I'll then be travelling up to Scotland for an event near Glasgow for Sir Jackie Stewart. He has a foundation called Race Against dementia. Helen, sure, or Lady Helen has dementia, and therefore he's raising awareness, raising funds to help accelerate the research into helping either. I don't know enough about the science, the medical science, to understand whether there's a cure or whether there's a process of making best of the situation. But I'll learn more at the event on Saturday night. And then I'll somehow very early get myself to PFI and then, you know, watch a bit of karting and then travel back to Monaco on Sunday night. You know, so we're back in the wee small hours of Sunday morning. And then Dayton will go back to school and I'll get back in the office. And then I'll be traveling to Valencia for an event, an AMG Mercedes Motorsport event night, which I'll be co-hosting. And then fly from there to San Francisco to be involved in a driving event called the Grand Toro, which is a Red Bull event where people get to drive their exotic cars near Pebble Beach. And then I'll travel Tuesday to Las Vegas. I'll be at an IWC Watches event with, I suspect, either Lewis or George on Tuesday. And then I get into the Grand Prix weekend of broadcasting. Everything's a day earlier in Vegas because the race is Saturday night. It's going to be cold there because of the time, so that's going to be quite challenging for the drivers. And then Sunday, I will fly via Seoul in Korea to Dubai, meet with some friends there for a couple of days, and then up to Abu Dhabi, which is only an hour, do the Grand Prix weekend, and then fly back to the UK for a couple of events on the Tuesday after the last Grand Prix. And then I'm into, you know, the throes of BRDC lunches, who own Silverstone, of course, and other events. And then eventually I'll find myself up in Scotland for Christmas and New Year. So that's kind of how the rest of my year plays out.
That is very busy. I can literally report I will be going to school and doing my mock exams. So that's all I've got going on. But I love it. And I think as well, it just shows that even if you're not racing in Formula One anymore, you're still incredibly busy with motorsport. And I think that's so funny. And that's just, it's so funny. I can't believe, how do you get time to sleep and eat? It's beyond me.
I actually, when I'm at home, I like to be in bed early, and because I like to wake up early. When I'm on the road, I, you know, decided by events. If I have a dinner, I have a dinner. So therefore, I've got no choice as to when that will finish, and I've got no choice as to when I have to wake up, because you've got to be on your schedule of which country you're in, what time the Grand Prix is at. You know, yeah. Mexico was a regular race time locally, so 2 o'clock, so you're at the track at a normal time. Like Abu Dhabi is evening, so you know everything finishes later. Like I think the drivers are going to be in driver's briefing in Vegas at like 1 or 2 in the morning, you know, which is a bit bizarre, but of course that you're playing to the time zone you're in.
I think as well it's just difficult, isn't it, just keeping up with everything. So man, that is a lot going on. Good luck, you know, sleeping and everything. So who are your motorsport heroes?
Well, I've got a great deal of admiration for anyone that's had success in motorsport, because it's taken work, it's taken creating opportunity, and it's taken talent, of course. So it's a little bit trying to remember a highlight from my career. I'm maybe not the best when it comes to sort of having something come straight to mind. You know, Jackie sure has played a huge part in my life and my career, because that created that staircase of talent, Paul Stewart Racing. So his achievements, 3 times world champion, you know, in the 60s and 70s, in a period when motorsport was incredibly dangerous. And he talks about how many of his friends that he buried, you know, and then he went racing again. It must have been, you know, must have been very much the sort of the mind of the, almost like the wartime, you know, the world wars. Just, it's mind-boggling to understand how families dealt with their sons and husbands heading off to war, as it traditionally was back then. You know, it was the men that were sent off to battle with no real knowledge or certainty if they'd ever see them again. You know, traumatic. But, you know, so I think the strength and resilience of the minds of the people from that period, I know you have to live for your time, but I can understand, you know, the youth of today, of which you're one, you probably roll your eyes at, you know, when older generation make comments. Could you go, well, where are they coming from? Well, they're coming from a different place, grew up in a different generation. Life didn't have the population it has today. It didn't have the wokeness that it has today. And of course, many things have changed for the better. There's no question in terms of opportunity and what have you for all. But equally, I think many things, you know, we all live in fear of saying the wrong thing because somebody might be offended. And that's where I turn to a lot of comedy, and I really admire a lot of comedians who have the strength of character and the ability to do what I think people should continue to be able to do, which is laugh at themselves. You know, we shouldn't be, you know, segregating and pointing and bullying. Of course not. That, you know, I've experienced that as a kid at school. You know, it's a horrible place to be pushed to one side or to be bullied, or, you know, but it's the cruelness of kids, isn't it? You know, kids will, you know, kids, of course, are just young adults. You know, human nature is such that for whatever reason, we will always pick on or single out. And, you know, I don't think we can ever imagine to not be, you know, not be human beings. And some human beings are full of kindness and some human beings are full of hate. It's just random nature of the world we live in. So, you know, I in many ways, I don't envy the challenge you have as a young person to navigate your way through the world today.
Yeah.
And I therefore, of course, I would, like everybody, would love to imagine living forever. The reality is, I look at the period that I was born and the opportunities that I've lived through. I think it was a great period, but I suspect most people of any generation probably think that of their period.
Yeah. And I think what you say about, like, the whole segregated and bully, it's definitely a massive thing. And I think there's never going to be a world where bullying's never going to, like, not be there. It's just going to be like, oh, no bullying. There's no world where that's going to happen realistically. But it is very difficult. And I think once you kind of get through it, I mean, I'm leaving school next year, hopefully doing an apprenticeship. So that kind of gets me out of that same, like, cycle of just, like, people being mean just for the sake of being mean. So yeah, I understand that. So if you could give one piece of advice to anyone wanting to compete in higher motorsport categories, what would that piece of advice be?
However hard you're working, work harder. You know, I wish I could have given myself that advice when I was younger. I remember when I was, there was a Formula One driver called Derek Warwick who does some F1 stewarding now. I saw him in Las Vegas. But my parents used to go to Jersey a lot because they had their honeymoon there. And they knew someone in a band, because my father loves music and plays guitar, whose kids went to the same school as Derek Warwick. And Derek was a Formula One driver. So through this rather knowing a friend who was able set up a lunch with Derek Warwick when I was 17 to go and get some advice on, you know, you're a Formula One driver, because we didn't really know anything about Formula One.
Yeah.
And I remember asking me what training I do. And I was like, well, I ride my bike and do a bit of swimming. And I remember him sort of asking how much, and I told him. And he was like, you got to do more than that. You have to be training, you know, minimum 40 minutes cardio to get into his theory at the time. And he asked if I wanted to go with a run with him the next morning at like 7 in the morning, and I was like, okay. I remember I slept through my alarm. I never went for the run. So
no,
I couldn't even wake up to go and do that. So yeah, I think I was always weight conscious because I was taller, but I probably could have been stronger earlier. And so I encouraged Aiton. He has a trainer to work on his strength and just to be ready for the event that's coming. So you're strong enough to hold on when things are tough, rather than just getting there. You know, being ready to finish the Grand Prix or whatever the race is when it's hot and sweaty, rather than having to stop because you weren't quite ready. So just work hard. And whatever you're doing, get off your phone, get in the gym. And even when you're in the gym, you know, my son will come in and he'll faff around getting the music he wants to listen to. I'm like, forget that. Get lost in your own mind. You know, even today, you know, I've got a rowing machine at home. I'll go and sit on it for half an hour or 40 minutes. And I'll get to maybe 10 minutes and I'll be like, I do not want to do 20 minutes, never mind 30 minutes. But I've been there before. It's just you're mentally, it's your mind trying to talk you out of it because it isn't fun. There's nowhere to hide. You're just sitting there stroking away. But you just got to get your mind focused and push on through and tell yourself someone else is doing it. So why not you be the someone else? Put the work in.
Yeah.
Because once it's done, it's banked. It's there. The work is done. And then you can have fun the rest.
So would you say, this is a complete side note again, but would you say mental and physical training are as important, or one's more important than the other?
They're hand in hand. For me, mental strength is about overcoming your desire to not want to do it. If you can't be bothered to do it, you don't have mental strength. You know, there'll be many psychologists out there, highly trained. There'll be many books out there that you can read, which will be inspirational. But in summary, you've got to get off your arse and go do it, because no one can do it for you. And if you can't get off your arse and go and do it, join a long line of people that are in the same mind space. And usually lack of commitment won't take a talent in whatever it is to the top. You've got to have commitment. And people thrive on knowing. In my life, I know there's people, if I send a message to, I probably won't get an answer. And if I do, it might take a week. And there's others. You send a message, poof, the response is there straight away. You know, so you just build up in yourself a knowledge of who's reliable and who to ask. And in life, if you are hardworking and reliable, I fail to see where you wouldn't be a successful or important member of whatever team you're in. And Formula One teams are, you know, they're electricians, they're plumbers, they're, you know, fabricators, they're, you know, any of the roles in everyday life can be in Formula One. So if you want to be in Formula One and you have a particular skill set or whatever, you knock on those doors long enough and you've got the credentials, or you meet the right people and show them that you've got commitment, and they go, look, I'm going to give this person a go. I'm going to give them a try and see. And then if you turn up on time and do what you're supposed to do quickly and efficiently, you then become an asset. And that's what a team is, bringing together a group of individuals who've got skills and motivation and a willingness to work together.
Yeah, I think as well, I mean, I can only use my story as like an example, but I've always wanted to be a presenter, but I never did anything about it. And then as soon as I saw, so Lissy McIntosh, she's just so inspiring to me. And I thought she got, when she started on TikTok, that was me. I started a TikTok account straight away. I've put in the work. I've done everything I can. I've reached out to people for advice. And again, if you don't ask, you're not going to get. So you keep working at it. And I mean, it's nothing compared to Formula One, because that is completely, you have to commit your life to it. But I think if you set your mind to something, you can do it. And I think it's all playing out for me at the minute, touch wood. But yeah, so I think that's really, really good piece of advice. So if you could get a paddock pass to any race in the world, where would you go? I mean, this is the question I ask everyone, so I'm excited to see your answer.
Silverstone. I would go there and I would camp like I have done for many, many years. And yeah, I think it's a fantastic race weekend, Silverstone. It's a great location. I love the camping and sharing of the experiences, you know, coming out of your motorhome and having a beer with the people around, having a little barbecue. It takes me to a happy place.
So Silverstone, would you ever like to see a race in Scotland?
Of course, that would be incredible, but there's Knockhill. That's where I first drove a race car. And that wouldn't be a facility that's capable of hosting a Grand Prix just for, you know, track and facilities. I think it's unlikely we'll ever see a Grand Prix track in Scotland. Jackie tried many years ago, back in the 80s, late 80s, early 90s, to get behind a thing called New Ingolston, because there used to be a track near Edinburgh Airport called Ingolston. And it didn't happen for whatever reason. So I just don't think there would be, I don't think the Scottish government would invest in a facility like that for various reasons. But if it was a world-class facility, then the world would come, you know, manufacturers would come. There's many, many manufacturers around the world, and they're busy most of the time. You know, if you look at Jonathan Palmer has built up a fantastic business with all of the various racetracks, you know, Brands Hatch and Snetterton and all these tracks, and they're busy businesses. But there's always going to be those who don't like motor racing or don't like whatever that are going to protest against it. You know, where is it? Where there's a racetrack? Oh, even in Austria, Red Bull Ring, there's a family live not far from the track, and they somehow have, you know, they have a restriction on how often the track can be used and how many noisy days can be done. Now, the track is also next to an airfield, and the Austrian military have their jets there, and they fly their jets every day.
Oh, my gosh.
But I suspect the family aren't able to tell the airfield, because it's military, you can't fly first thing in the morning or you can't fly at night. They have to fly to be ready. War doesn't happen between 9 and 5 o'clock. You know, war happens at rainy, that happens at night. So, yeah. Not everyone's is a fan of motorsport. So I guess there'll always be somebody who doesn't want a track.
So thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Thank you for listening to the Paddock Pass podcast with me, Evie Spencer. Make sure to follow this podcast for more episodes and head over to my socials for more motorsport content.